Hey, Dinks! Welcome to Dentists in the Know. This is your backstage pass for current trends, politics, and education in the dental world. I'm Dr. Jeff Horowitz. With me is Dr. Jennifer Bell, you know her as JB, and Dr. Chad Duplantis. We are all practicing dentists, we are all educators, and we are all business owners. Our job is to bring all of you in the know. JB's on the screen for the opening comment.
It's a big day.
It's a big day. Chad's away. The Dinks will play. Hey, everyone. I'm Jeff Horowitz, and next to me is the wonderful Dr. Jennifer Bell. We are the Dentists in the Know. Unfortunately, Dr. Chad Duplantis can't be with us tonight. Have some family things going on, and we wish him and his daughter Ava and his wife Ellen all of the best. Everything's going to be great. We miss you, Chatty, but looking forward to having you back next week. In the meanwhile, welcome to Hump Day Hour. We are the Dentists in the Know, and this is your backstage pass for current trends, politics, and education in the dental world. It's live, and it's over a wee bit of a cocktail. You can have whatever you like. It can be wine. It can be bourbon. It can be rum. It could be a lot of things for that matter. It could be coffee. We don't care. Just have a good time with us. Dr. Jennifer Bell and myself, as well as Dr. Chad Duplantis, we are all practicing dentists. We are all business owners, and we are all educators. And as you can tell from the title of our group, our job is to bring all of you in the know. So with that, welcome, JB. How you doing? How was your week?
So far, so good. This is a big week in my house. Masters Week is the sporting event of the year. Maybe there's a few one-offs here and there, a big rivalry that may manifest itself, but we are definitely in our zone right now, hence the color of my shirt. I've never won the coveted green blazer, would never be invited to win the coveted green blazer. But I will proudly support my green throughout the week in honor of one of our favorite sporting events of the year. How about you?
Oh, I love the Masters as well. So who is there a pick amongst everyone in the house that everyone feels good about?
No, I think I have to go back and watch some coverage today. Oh, and, okay. And watching the kids, their kids coming out was so fun today, too. Yeah. I got to tell you, this this rookie out of North Carolina, this little phenom, I think could be an interesting watch for the week. I don't know how you feel about that.
But, I always love the amateurs in the tournament. Well, listen, we have a killer guest tonight.
I'm so excited.
I am, too, because this is, I mean, you know, you're actually doing a good bit of education on 3D printing and sure, digital workflows right now. This is something that for me has been really a struggle. I mean, we've been doing CAD/CAM for 20 something years now. I mean, adopted that very quickly and easily, tried to kind of roll with the punches, and then, you know, 3D printing came around, and then it was just kind of the wild, wild west, because it was like, you know, what are you using for your capture? Then who are you getting to do your design? Are you going to do your design yourself? Then, you know, do you buy a printer that's a closed system where you can only use their materials, mm-hmm, or can only use, you know, or, you know, you don't have the ability to have as much input on the design side. So there's just so many questions. And I think right now, every office should have a 3D printer. This is the future of dentistry. But even before you get to 3D printing, I think there's this piece that we're missing right now, which is that we think that occlusion and articulation is best handled in a traditional manner, meaning on an articulator after a face bow transfer, you know, with the use of articulation paper. And, you know, there's a lot of things that a lot of people have to unlearn in a path towards developing digital occlusion and articulation protocols. So our guest tonight, JB, long intro, our guest tonight is a pretty phenomenal guy. He, you know, we've run a lot in the same circles, though we haven't known each other for very long. You know, I've been involved with Dr. Mark Piper and Dr. Jim McKee for a long time in the study of temporomandibular joint issues, how it relates to restorative. And, you know, one of the big questions has always been, imaging has always been huge. One of the big questions has always been about splint design and articulation and developing protocols that will allow you to have very accurate splint design. And so that's always been an issue. And then this guy comes rolling around, Dr. Seth Atkins, who has really done so much just taking the information he had and diving into digital articulation and digital occlusion studies. And pretty remarkable guy. I just got to hear him speak at the American Equilibration Society. So Dr. Seth Atkins was born and raised in Lubbock, Texas. He is a graduate of the University of Texas Health Sciences School of Dentistry in San Antonio. He happens to be a visiting faculty for Spear Education and also works alongside Dr. Jim McKee as faculty at the Chicago Study Club. He's a fellow of the AGD, a fellow of the International Congress of Oral Implantology, and he has a practice in Waxahachie, Texas. And man, there's a few good dentists in Texas. You know, we just have judged everything on Chad. And come to find out, we've had two really good dentists on right in the last couple of weeks. So anyway, let's bring Seth up. Seth, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you guys?
Doing great. So, you know, contrary to what our opinion was of Texas dentistry, yeah, apparently there are a few good clinicians there.
Who would have thought, you know?
Who would have thunk?
If you hung out with Chad, no one would think.
Who we hang out with, right?
Well, I used to practice in Fort Worth, and I had to get away from Chad, so I had to South Dallas.
The reputation.
We love you, Chad, and Chad is a phenomenal clinician. We just love to tease him.
Do you also beat him on the golf course?
It depends.
Okay.
Let me throw this out there, JB. So during his presentation at AES, he's got a lot of golf references, and I'm going to tell you, I think he is every bit as much a perfectionist about his golf game as he is with digital protocols and digital articulation. My guess is you're about, what, a 2 handicap?
4 or 5, somewhere in there.
4 or 5, yeah. See? Yeah.
Maybe you can go to the Masters.
I would love to go. So I never had the chance.
Have you ever been?
I have not.
Oh gosh, you gotta do for someone. Who
I was
loves
only the there
game,
for 4 hours.
Yeah.
My crazy story with the Masters, you know, I was sitting there watching it with my grandfather. I used to watch it with him all the time. And he had never said anything about it. And I want to say it was on 12. You know, somebody had gotten off course kind of in the azaleas over there. And he's like, yeah, I got lost my ball there the time I played it as well. I was like, come again?
Wait, what?
And you played Augusta? He goes, yeah. He had gone out there. It was a business deal back, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And he got to go out there and play it. And they stayed the night out there. And I was like, you just don't casually drop that in a conversation. Especially after I've been watching the tournament with you 10 years at this point.
Yeah. You should have a t-shirt for this by now. What are we doing? Well,
that's what I'm saying. I mean, I don't know how that happens, but.
Yeah. By the way, I stayed at Buckingham Palace one night.
You slept in Buckingham Palace? Are you serious?
No. That's just not the kind of thing you drop on somebody in casual conversation.
No. Well, like what you just did. Oh, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, probably the equivalent. Well, Seth, tell us a little bit about your journey in general dentistry. You've not been out all that long, But really, you've kind of conquered a lot of things in a fairly short time. So tell us a little bit about your journey, and then particularly lead into, you know, what made you go down this digital path? I know you do a lot of things in your practice, but what got you so excited about digital, and what did you see as the opportunities of digital dentistry?
Sure. I kind of got lucky at the start in that, you know, the first associateship I had when I graduated school, they were already scanning. So I was able to incorporate that into my practice very early on. This is probably 08, somewhere in that ballpark. And we scan for a number of years. You just take the scan, send it to the lab. A few weeks later, a crown comes back. But there really wasn't much you could do with the data. And, you know, the data was stuck in space. We're in the real world. It's how do we go back and forth to actually do something with it? And that's what kind of started me going down that path. And then you'd kind of touched a little bit about Mark and Jim and running the same circles. When we started looking more at splints, yeah, I would get frustrated because you'd do all the things and send it to the lab, and you would get some back that were very close, and others came back that weren't so close, and you felt like you had the same input. Why am I not getting the same output? And when you started to look at more of the imaging on the MRI and CBCT side, if you overlay that with the articulators, you realize that, especially in the joint patients, a number of these patients really don't match the articulator very well. And if you kind of unpack that further, that starts to explain sometimes why things fit better than others. And, you know, I went back and took some of the scans on the splints I would consider that fit well and started putting them over the articulator. And they were much closer to the anatomic average values that most of these articulators are built off of. And that's kind of when the light bulb went off that, you know, if we're lucky enough to get a patient who is quote unquote average, you know, life's pretty easy. Things fit pretty well. It looks pretty good. But yeah, I came to kind of realize many of the patients that need restoration aren't really average, you know, most of which really didn't achieve average. They didn't grow like they should have. And that's your class twos, joint patients, you know, good patients with good joints that grew normally don't tend to thrash their teeth. And I think we've kind of missed the boat in possibly basing our articulators on what average is, when average for the average human doesn't need a full mouth restoration most times. And so we may not have the right audience.
Hey, Dinks podcast listeners. After the show, be sure and rate and review your favorite Dink. I mean, rate and review Dinks as one of your favorite podcasts.
I heard that.
We'd love to hear what you have to say. Thanks for listening in. See you next time.
When you have that type of information, now that you've sort of gleaned the fact that the traditional articulator isn't going to well represent, it will say 60% of your patient population, 50%, whatever that statistical value ends up being, how do you then translate that? Where's the evolution of where we're going to go in dentistry to take that new advancement of information to maybe make this part of dentistry a little bit more predictable for folks?
Sure. Yeah, I think 3D printing has really kind of been the key to a lot of that, because you can take the data and you can, you know, there's really three phases to digital. There's acquisition, and that's your scans, all your data collection. Then you've got what I would term manipulation, which is where you can do something with that data to make it usable. Mm-hmm. But at the end, you need a means of production at the end of it. And, you know, wasn't cost effective for most practices to bring in a mill that's capable of doing splints and models and everything, just because, you know, milling a model is cost prohibitive in most instances.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And printing really kind of changed the game there, because now you can get something in your office for even an entire ecosystem's under $12,000-$13,000.
Yeah, easy.
And, you know, I would argue it's something that you can get almost an instantaneous ROI on. And, you know, with the scanners, they always had the marketing tribe for a long time that, oh, you're going to save this much in polyvinyl siloxane every year. It's going to pay for itself. I mean, nobody pre-buys $30,000 of polyvinyl siloxane anymore. And then, then you throw on the, you know, monthly maintenance fees and all that, and mm-hmm. it was a break even at best. And the truth is, once you start doing something with that data, that's really where your ROI comes in on the full ecosystem, scanner included. You know, when you start printing your provisionals, doing your splints, doing your models, wax ups, you know, those are instances where you can obtain mm-hmm. ROI very quickly. And, you know, makes a huge difference almost instantaneously. I mean, because what do you got? What do they charge you guys for a wax up for a tooth?
I've heard anywhere from $50 to $100 a tooth.
So I'd say, you know, most, I'd say average is 75 when I ask that question.
Yep.
And, you know, if you look at that, let's just go on the low end. Let's say you've got a 15 tooth wax up at $50 a piece. That's $750. You know, to do that digitally now, it costs you roughly $4 to print the model. And if you're doing it, if you buy the software yourself, you know, ExoCAD may set you back $10K, but you just netted $750 the first case you did.
That's
right. And that doesn't take long to really add up. You know, digital splints are the same way. You know, a digital splint from Great Lakes Ortho is probably $350. It costs about $6 in 10 minutes to do yourself. Or you could outsource that design as well for under 20.
Or like $30 or something. Yeah.
And so it doesn't take long to leverage that if you just get comfortable to really generate a return, not only monetarily, but even clinical efficiency chair side. You know, I can, you know, many times now, if I'm seating a case, I'll have the splint printed. If I seat a case in the morning, I'll have their splint fully fabricated by the afternoon. So I don't have to worry about 3 weeks of waiting on the lab to do it. You don't have to, you know, you can give that, you know, protection instantaneously if that's what you want to do. And at a lower cost, I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer at that point.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I've toyed around with this comment a couple of times, just see where it lands. But I think you and I are about the same generation graduating from dental school. I foresee within the next 5 years that new docs will not acquire milling. Oh, it's okay. Milling machines to any great extent anymore. I think between an intraoral scanner and what we're going to be able to do with printing, what we can currently do with printing, I'm not sure you're going to see as much of an uptake of milling.
Yeah, I apologize with my dog. He's an idiot. But
It's fine.
We're all dog owners, so we get it.
But no, I agree with you. I mean, I would probably put the over under at 15 years, you know, in terms of, and with the caveat on that the material science has to continue to advance. You know, that's kind of where the renaissance is right now in printing is there's new materials popping up every day. That's probably simultaneously one of the biggest weaknesses because, you know, no different than, you know, some of the Seltzer blocks you had in Cerec and some of the, what was the three lava ultimate or 3M.
The word we shall not speak of.
Yeah. Some of those were a disaster. And that's the big, I guess, problem yet is we don't know for sure what's going to work and what doesn't. And that's probably a little more of the Wild West aspect, I would say, at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got some things that are very promising and are doing quite well. You know, they've got those ceramic reinforced resins now that, at least on paper, qualify as a ceramic crown. I've got a lot of them I'm testing over the last couple of years that are doing good. Yeah, can't tell you I'm 100% comfortable billing that as a ceramic crown at this point, but some of them are holding up a lot better than I would have given it credit for. And I was purposely trying to find scenarios where they should fail, and they've done better than I thought, to be quite honest.
Hey, Jeff, apparently it's come to our attention that you and I suck at the news.
Yeah, Chad, I've actually kind of known that for a while, and that's why what we've had to do is give people more of what they really deserve, which is more JB. So we actually have a segment now called News on the Go with Dennis in the Know. In fact, I like the idea of JB's News on the Go with Dennis in the Know. So stay tuned for that. It's its own podcast. I'm really excited about it, and guess what? There's no Chad and Jeff.
I would agree with that. We've been actually using a few of these. I particularly love that material, those hybrid resin ceramic hybrids, if you will, that are being put under ceramic coats. We've been using those for a while, but particularly where I love them is over implants, because you get a little bit more on the aesthetic end than you will with just a hard zirconia, but you also have a little bit more give built into the system. And so they tend to really hold up well in those applications. They're also great materials to put in a transitional full mouth rehab case, just because you also have that built in flexural strength, and it just seems to work really well. And And I'm like you, when I first put them in, I really expected there to be shortcomings with some of the bonding. I also worried a little bit about the wear on them. And honestly, I would agree. I think they've done much better than any of us would have expected them to have done.
I would say the nicest thing with implant crowns as well is, you know, invariably that mesial contact walks its way open as the patient bone remodels. And you can pop it reprint, add a little bit, put it right back with the same file.
You have the ability. Right. Exactly.
Well, exactly. And could you even, I don't know, could you just prep a class two on it?
You can't. You can bond to them as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest game changer for me, honestly, is bigger aesthetic cases printing the provisionals fully contoured. You know, so you'll take your definitive scan, you can combine that with your wax up. And instead of having to have a matrix and a jig and fully in reline shells, they're fully contoured when you print them. And there's two huge advantages to that. One is die spacer for your cement. So instead of having to hydraulically overcome all your temporary cement when you reline on chair side, you can build in your die spacer to be compatible with it. So seating a full, if you're splinting provisionals, seating that becomes much easier because you're not having to overcome the hydraulic aspect. And virtually, it'll block out any undercuts if you're splinting. So you don't have to worry about locking it in. Because nothing's worse than trying to take off 6 or 8 units and you crack one. And you know you just wasted an hour and 20 minutes at least trying to reline it, put it back together.
Yeah.
A lot of times what I'm doing now is, you know, we'll merge all that chair side, go ahead and print them. But go ahead and print a backup copy as well because they're only $2 or $3 a piece. And now I like to do them as individual units. Both from phasing a case has a lot of benefits because instead of having to bring the patient back in and re-impress every time, if you've got that fully contoured STL and it didn't take much adjustment, you can just send that to the lab and have them convert it to porcelain. So we've been phasing cases over years where instead of bringing the patient back in, we'll just send those files out. The lab makes them and you just pop two crowns off, put the definals on, and you can, you know, if you're in a PPO environment, you can charge the insurance and be a lot more efficient. And then also just for remaking a case, if we're going to take it apart, just to have another set of provisionals already done. You don't have to worry about breaking anything. You can pop them off, put them on. And hygiene is vastly improved because they're individual units. They can floss. And you've got perfect contours that I'm just not going to spend 4 hours making chair side all the time to get. And it just makes life so much simpler in that regard.
I love it.
When you're operating, I'm going to get super technical, and I'm really sorry for users who or listeners who aren't maybe experimenting with this yet. But as the wheels are turning in my brain and thinking, okay, are you designing your prep designs in ExoCAD as well? So in order to make, you know, adequate temps that you can then go, unless it's fully additive dentistry, you've got to have some reductive piece on that original model that you're sending in. Talk us through a little bit about that, because even if you're not doing your own design work, there have been times where I've thought maybe I want to ask the lab to fabricate for me a temporary bridge or something. So it's a little bit more rigid, a little more predictable, less chair time. And invariably it doesn't work. Like it doesn't fit or I don't know. So it doesn't seem to translate quite like I think I want it to. So talk us through your workflow and how you're doing it your office.
And you know, I've kind of been in like a transition as well, because when I started doing all this, there really wasn't a lot of lab collaboration, or there really wasn't an instruction manual. So a lot of things, when we were putting things together, I'd have to go to a Facebook lab group or ask questions and just kind of dig till you found somebody who had the same problem. And, you know, if you look at the lab side, most labs today use one or two softwares, 3Shape or ExoCAD.
Right.
And because we as clinicians never learn anything about it, one, we really don't know what we need to empower the lab to use it to its potential. And so when I started to play around with the software, I automatically gained a lot better understanding of, oh, this is what we can do with it, but here's the information I need to provide to my lab to utilize it more efficiently or better. And when we look at that, a lot of light bulbs started going off because, okay, here's what I need to give them. But for everybody that's scanning and sending cases to the lab now, yeah, I would challenge you to ask a question of your lab. How are they programming the articulator? Because if you only give them the virtual scan, you get this crown back. How are they programming? How are they doing everything they do to set your cusp heights and excursive movements? And
so let's stop right there. Yeah, because I think this is really where I wanted to get to. So, you know, let's say somebody is just now, you know, getting where they feel really comfortable with capturing, maybe not into design yet, but they're maybe doing some bigger cases and they're like, okay, now I've captured this beautiful image of my preps, everything's great. Yep. Now the lab says, you know, we just use a standard articulation package. What do you say to them, or what is a dentist's next logical step to understanding and then explaining to the lab what they would expect from digital articulation?
Sure. And so backtracking a little bit, and this ties into your question as well, JB, on what does that workflow look like on it? And there's really two ways to accomplish that. One is on the diagnostic side before you even prep the tooth. So if we're giving the lab what they need to mount the case via analog or virtual and the tools to program that articulator, they can design our wax up off of that. And then many times, you know, we take that wax up to the mouth, further refine it. That's when you send a go-by back mm-hmm. for the lab to make those changes. And that's just an acknowledgement that the patient articulator is different from what we have on the tabletop. And so when I'm prepping, working up a case, you know, we do all the diagnostics, send that in, and I'll have a wax up based on that diagnostics. And for reduction, I'll usually flash on the wax up or 3D print an overlay of where I want to go if we're being additive. And then I'll prep through that for my reduction for the on that part of it. Having the wax up handy to virtually combine is really nice, though, because when I do that, you instantaneously have feedback on what your proposed restoration thickness. So if mm-hmm. I see I've underprepped, I don't have to wait to go to the lab to have them find that out. I can go ahead, just cut that part out of the scan, reduce a little more, and rescan just that section. It takes all of 30 seconds to do, but it saves you that headache on the back end or the phone call of it. And that also really applies when you start marking the margins and having the provisionals fully printed, because you get instantaneous feedback on your margins and your scan accuracy. If you print that provisional and it doesn't fit like a glove, you already know I've got an issue in that area, and you can troubleshoot it right then, as opposed to sending it in, getting it back, having an open margin, retemporization, you know, all those things. They're just headaches during the day. And then, you know, there's a couple labs now that are developing services, kind of what you said, where if you have the pre-wax up done, you can basically make an appointment with the technician. So if I'm going to prep a full arch at 8, I can have an appointment set for 9:30, and the technician's already got the wax up loaded, and they're expecting my definitive scan. And you can send it to them, and it takes them roughly 25 minutes to combine those, and you can go have coffee, check another patient, do whatever you want to. And then they drop in Dropbox all those provisional files, fully contoured, ready to print. So my team can then grab those out, print them, do everything back of house, and I can come back 40 minutes later with all of them ready to seat, ready to go. And I really think that's going to be the future, because I get, you know, 13,000 on a printer, 10,000 on ExoCAD, all this stuff, plus, you know, what seems daunting and learning all of it takes time. And if we can broach that gap by, as long as you have a printer mm-hmm. and a scanner, and you're willing to let the technician work with you in that sense, I think it gets rid of a lot of hurdles for implementation.
So I have a super silly question, because I think about this. I haven't made the true leap to stocking Crown & Bridge resin in the practice, because for me, I keep thinking, okay, well, which shades do I choose? Am I going to stock every shade that they sell? How do you manage? Because I'm not doing any, for me at this point, I'm not doing final provisional or final restorations in Crown & Bridge resin, because I also have a milling machine. So I'm still going to just lean in on that for the materials that I'm comfortable using. But I've wanted to sort of take that next step into starting to print temporary restorations or even overlays and that type of thing as we're working out bites and opening up verticals, et cetera. Are you stocking every shade? Are you stocking some standard shades that you find are pretty routinely helpful?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I rarely have patients who ask for temps in A3, so I don't keep anything like
that. That's true.
So really, you know, B1, A1, A2 is kind of the three that I keep. And you know, obviously, it's always easier to decrease value than it is to add it back. So if you start with something higher value in that B1 range, most of these you can stain down. You know, Wally Renee at Mod Institute has that candy coating technique that works really well. And so we can get, you know, you can get that A0 down to an A2 with the stain and glaze if you want to spend the time. And so generally, if I was going to be starting from scratch, I would get the lighter end with the higher values, and knowing we can decrease that with chroma and shade if we need to.
Sounds reasonable. It's a good starter package because a lot of people are very overwhelmed with the amount of resins that they might need to keep in stock or, you know, have available to them at any given time. And I do think that's the one next like mental step you have to make to say, okay, what, but it's not a composite box where I literally have every shade under the sun. You know, for the cases that this would work well for, what are the three or four shades I'd probably lean on? And then how do I modify it to make it work? You could do a cutback too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you always have your composites sitting there and guess what? They bond to that Crown and Bridge resin just fine. So,
well, and if you were just getting really started, you know, the Onyx resin, which is a Sprint Ray product that's meant for hybrids, is probably my favorite provisional resin material. It looks very much like Emax on X-ray. So you can actually get a radiograph, see your margins in the middle. It's tough as nails, and they've got three or four shades that you can shade down pretty easily. And so if you're trying, because I mean, every one of those bottles is $400 or $500 a bottle,
right?
Which seems like a bunch till you break it down to, you know, your average provisional takes 2 milliliters. And so if you've got a 500 milliliter bottle, and that may even be a little high, you got 250 provisionals in that bottle. But even at $500, it's only $2 a piece, which is cheaper than Bisacryl at that point, or very close cost-wise. So it seems like a bunch because you're dumping it all in one bottle at a time. But really, I think we're going to end up being the more cost-efficient modality printing than we are chair sacks. You think about how much excess you waste, all the trimming time, all the flash you have to get rid of. You know, I think it's a tremendous potential to maybe make that better.
Seth, we have a question.
Sure.
Talking about which stain and glaze systems are you using and what's your workflow with stain and glaze systems?
I was using Tokuyama for a while, and then I'm totally blanking on the name. Wally had recommended one with better chemistry with some of the resin 3D printing ones. And I'll have to send you the brand on it because I've got it at the office. I can see the vial in my head or the cartridge, but I cannot think about what it is. Yeah, I saw that question. I was
that
thinking
never
about
happens
that.
To me.
You'll remember at 2 a.m. tonight and sit right up in your bed and go, it's blah.
Exactly. Well, see, I've got in my office a team member named Cindy. If I need anything, I just tell Cindy and it appears 3 days later. And that's basically
I have
my
a Cindy.
System.
My Cindy's been with me almost 30 years and she's still, I say, get me that thing. Oh, they know.
If I go see a patient on the weekend, I'm calling her like, where'd y'all put this? And then, yeah, we joke, we've got those quiet closed drawers. So patients don't know I'm looking for things frantically in the back. So I've got no clue where anything is. It just shows up when I need it. But general workflow, take the printer, you know, you do your wash, get everything ready. I generally like to stain and glaze before I do my final post curing. So you save time getting both of them cured at the same time. I'll take them off, do a light air abrasion, and then the Tokuyama ones, you can just stain directly on top. And then for the final seal, instead of palace seal, I actually use a little bit of that resin on cure, paint that on, and do the final cure to seal it in.
And we had another question come in. How important is it to use a radiolucent temp so you can see your margins or potentially, you know, look at your margins in areas that you may not be able to see clinically? So what do you think about the radiolucency of your provisional material? What is that an important factor for you?
I like a little bit of radiopacity, you know, more like Emax. And the Emax is probably my favorite material to look at on a radiograph because you can see it. You can see how well it's adapted. If you get some of the ones that are completely radiolucent, you really don't get a lot of feedback outside of visual because you can't see it.
Yeah.
That was kind of really the main reason I like that Onyx tough resin so much is it's maybe just a slightly lighter version, you know, similar to Emax on the X-ray, maybe just a little more radiolucent, but it gives you that same feedback where you can see everything interproximally and feel good that you've got a good adaptation in those areas.
Especially for those long-term temps. where you think you're, you know, either you're working through bite issues, opening vertical, your state, like what you mentioned, you're staging the treatment, you know, where maybe they can only afford to do so much at any given time. So you're just sequentially starting to move that through. It's nice to know that at least what you're putting in is going to serve for a comfortable period of time. And when you open it up, it's not going to be worse than when you started.
Well, yeah. And a lot of these too, let's just say you had that scenario where you open vertical and you, whether with temps or printed on lays or however you decide to do it, and you make significant adjustments, you can design your case strategically where you've got certain areas unprepped or unchanged. And those become great fiduciaries to align things. Because computers are better at aligning things than we could ever be. And that's really the leverage we have is, you know, all these digital records can get distilled down to ones and zeros. So they got the same substructure. And because of that, you can combine your MRI with your CBCT with your intraoral scan. And the computers are the best at making those things align. That alignment is what allows us to leverage that technology. So like, let's just say you're prepping a full arch case. You know, the problem is you lost all your reference points because you don't want to use soft tissue as a reference. A lot of times what we'll do strategically is I may decide to leave the canines unprepped till the very end. So get your rough preps done everywhere else. Leave the two canines untouched. Take a quick interim scan to give you the alignment so those canines are there. Then go ahead and prep the canines. You can go back, copy that scan, just take those preps in. But what that does for the lab is it gives them a great alignment point so they can stitch those scans together. And you mentioned earlier you had some where you didn't feel like they fit well, the margins weren't right. That would be the first question I would check to see is, did we give enough strategically for alignment as for terms of fiducials to allow the lab to make that stitch very easily to it?
Well, now when I think about it, I haven't done any of that since I moved to digital. That was all back in my analog days. And I got so jaded with it during the analog stages of trying to send impressions to the lab, have them, you know, pre-made temporaries. And it did not go super great. And I was like, oh, I don't think this process works. But I really appreciate, you know, sort of reopening that part of my mind to say, well, you know, maybe now with the digital piece of your workflow being vastly different from where you used to be, that, you know, maybe it was more the workflow and not the concept.
Sure.
And I think, you know, when we were struggling through many of the analog things that we were trying to make work for us, we were living in that hybrid stage a lot more. It was definitely more hit and miss. And for young hands, and at that time I was very green as a dentist, like my shirt, I took ownership of all of it and said, oh, I just must really suck at giving you information, you know, or whatever. And it doesn't work well in my hand. So it's nice to, I think for all clinicians to sort of dust off those parts of the brain that you sort of put to bed and said, oh, that just didn't work well in my hands, and maybe re-challenge it with new techniques and products and technology. See if we could do it differently.
Absolutely.
So I like them a lot.
So let's switch gears for a second, because one of the ways that distributors and companies, you know, tell dentists that they can see an immediate ROI with 3D printing is with the bite splints that they're already making. I mean, it's probably one of the simpler workflows in getting into digital, capturing an image, you know, and then fabricating a bite splint, having that bite splint to the patient much faster than they could ever get it from the lab, and hopefully with as much accuracy. So talk us through some of the workflow for the average dentist, because it can be really frustrating when you get a bite splint back and, you know, you've done everything right. You've taken a face bow to, you know, to average parameters like we've talked about. And as you said, it's the people who typically need bite splints or have joint problems are not going to be the people that fall within those statistical averages. So it makes sense why a lot of those cases, you know, have to be ground down so much or why it never seems to fit. So talk us through the workflow of a typical bite splint, if you would.
Sure. You know, if you look at the essence of kind of what we're trying to accomplish with the face bow, right? The goal of the face bow is just to relate your maxilla to the condyles. And the problem with the face bow is you can't really get that digitally very easily. You know, you've got this analog face bow and you've got the virtual articulator, and how do you make the two coalesce to make it useful? And there's really two different ways you can tackle that. One, you know, if you're doing more joint patients and you've got access to CBCT image, if you've got an image that's a big enough field of view that you can see the condyles and the maxilla, that's really all you're looking for with the face bow anyway. Relate the maxilla to the condyles. So you can take what we started doing on a lot of them was digitally just taking that CT, dropping it into the design software and aligning the maxillary scan to the CT. And then you can move those as one unit and just put the condyles over the articulator. And that was kind of the process I was doing early on when I kind of figured you started to see a lot of these patients' condyles don't fit the articulator condyles. You know, almost every semi-adjustable articulator is based on 110 millimeters. And it took me a long time to actually figure out where that number came from. Because if you measure patients, I've gotten hundreds of CTs on patients for different things. I never had one that's been 110 at the middle of the condyle, let alone the medial pole. And where they took that from was a Lee pantograph. So when they used through the pantographic tracings, the recording elements on the Lee were at 110 millimeters. And so when they were trying to make the semi-adjustable analog articulator match those tracings, they just put the medial pole at 110 to see if they can make it match those tracings on it. The reality is you have a lot more patients closer to 75 than you do 110. And we get worked up being 4 millimeters off the hinge axis, you know, or, you know, like a range of an ear bow is 5 millimeters from that true hinge axis on average. You know, 40 millimeters at the intercondylar distance, in my opinion, has a bigger impact on that occlusion than being 3 millimeters off the true hinge axis relation. And that argument started a fight with a few different prosthodontists I've talked with. But yeah, that was the beauty of doing things digitally. So for splints, I use a software called D3 Tools, which is actually written by a dentist. And when he wrote it, he happened to also be a programmer. It's super cheap. It's like $600. You own the software for life. There's no monthly fees or anything to it. But it's very intuitive for design because it's kind of a workflow-based deal. But what grabbed my eye was how you articulate the model. There's just basically a little slider that you drag it forward and back, up and down. And it takes three measurements. The measurements for each condyle to the middle of the incisors and an angle through the horizontal plane at the top of the upper member. And how I do my splints mostly today, honestly, is I'll just take those same measurements off the CBCT. So with any CBCT, as long as you've got that field of view, just measure each condyle to the incisal edge and that angle from orbitally through the condyle down to that same angle. And you can drag and drop and have your splint fully articulated in like 2 seconds. And then from there, you just go through the workflow of designing the splint. It takes 7-8 minutes start to finish when you get comfortable with it. And the only other thing I would recommend in that scenario is just make sure you take your bite or your vertical, your scan at the desired vertical of your splint. Because anytime we start to change vertical, if we're not commensurate with the hinge axis, we're going to start to induce error. And so to be as accurate as possible, it gives you a quick way to troubleshoot. Because if you take your bite at that vertical and all your dots don't line up immediately, you know you had an error somewhere in seating that you're not down where you should be. Because the articulator really only handles the excursives. So static should be pretty dang close every time, unless something was monkeyed up in the process going through it.
So two more questions, because you know, you were talking about Dr. Lee and all the original studies that got us to 110 millimeters, which is what the Panadent articulator, many other articulation systems were developed from. But one of the things about the, say, the Coy's face bow is you're also getting aesthetic information, the X, Y, and Z axis. So how do we then have the ability to have that display? Because a lot of times in full mouth rehabilitation or, you know, phase two of a TMJ case, we're wanting to open the bite posteriorly. But, you know, it used to be, oh, everyone would just add to the lower posteriors. Well, you know, if it's the maxillary posteriors that have been intruded and they're what's off the occlusal plane, then you want to build those up. Or maybe it's building up, you know, if it's a unilateral joint problem, maybe it's building up the upper left and the lower right. And that's one of the places that the Coy's face bow was so useful, was in having that information for the lab. So what's your view on that?
There's a couple ways you could do it, you know, because there's two types of face bows. You have an anatomic face bow and an aesthetic face bow, and those cover the exact things we were just discussing. You can use digital photography or a 3D scan, face scan, in place of your aesthetic face bow. because we're simply aligning our scans to the either cut out of the photographs or the 3D scan, that gives you your aesthetic reference to get everything oriented where you want it to be. Or the other way to do it would be simply stake your quartz bow wafer like you're used to and scan the wafer, and you can bring that into ExoCAD, your design software, and align that wafer. And that allows you to make that aesthetic correction in the software, because the software has
Atkins Dentistry and Humane Society.
Yeah, we may need to have a dog for adoption here shortly. Because I don't know what he's barking at. But
don't worry about it.
So to overcome that, you can actually scan that quartz bow wafer and actually, because you can scan anything you want with your articulator, with your scanner. So it doesn't necessarily have to be teeth. So take that quartz wafer. You don't have to have the wings on it, but take the white part with the bite registration. Just scan that with your intraoral scanner. You can send that to the lab, and they can very easily put those together and make the correction that way.
Very cool. Very cool. And last piece, we're actually out of time. Boy, I want to have you on for another show because I've learned as much as I've learned on just about any show just from this talk. Talk about excursive movements now. And you know, what are you telling them in terms of, yeah, you can show what centric looks like. How do you then, if you're not designing yourself and you're sending this off to the lab or you're getting into more advanced articulation, how do you show where everything is at in excursions to make it all reconcile?
Sure. Yeah. You know, so that kind of goes back to that initial question of how do you program the virtual articulator, right? And There's two scenarios where you can do that. One is you need an analog model in the exact same position, with the idea there being if you've got identical positioning between the two, if you program the analog, you can put those values back into the digital and they'll match. Because if you look at ExoCAD and you pull up the Artex articulator, that Artex is identical to the one you got on your benchtop, down to the millimeter. All the same programming, same inputs. And when we looked at it, if you program them the same, they actually move identically in that scenario. So one option is get an model in the same spot. The way they did that traditionally was mount it on the analog articulator, and they would scan the whole articulator with the models to bring that into the design software. That works, but it means you've got to go analog and go through all those mounting steps, and you know, you've got the time investment there. That was the first part when we invented some or looked at some jigs. And the nice thing with virtual is you can implant coordinates into certain things. And we had some jigs designed that interface with your models that you can load them into. When you load them into ExoCAD, they load in the same position every time relative to the articulator, not the model. So you can put a model in ExoCAD, and as long as when you load that jig, they intersect, it snaps on the analog articulator in the exact same position. That was the first way that we would then program that digital, was you program the analog because they're in that same position, put that back in the digital world, and you had something that was interchangeable. Today, how I'm doing it is with patient motion, like a mod job. In these instances, we can capture all the patient's actual motion in real time, and that doesn't necessarily
That's happen. What I was leading into, was hearing where you were going with that.
Yeah, and so now you can have them actually function and chew and masticate and grind and do all those things. And it's basically a high-speed camera that sits in front of the patient, and they wear a couple of fiducials so they can track it. You know, the best analogy I've come up with is kind of like photogrammetry for occlusion. Instead of doing implant positioning with it, you just use the camera to help articulate the mandible in space relative to the maxilla. And all that data can be used in real time to carve a wax up. So now if I'm putting the wax up in, you can cut out any one of those motions and instantaneously adapt your wax up to that actual motion. So you've got no error. You know, you don't have to worry about if you have a disc on one condyle, not on the other, any quirks and movements, that's all captured in real time when you do it. And then that data also serves to mount the model, and it kicks out programming values for your analog articulator. So if you need to go to the lab and the lab ends up mounting it to check the case, they already have all the values based off the patient's actual motion to put into the analog articulator to give you the best approximation possible of the patient. And so for us, it's probably the last piece of the puzzle I would add. You need your scanner first, then I would add the printer and the software, ideally simultaneously, because that's where you have the most leverage. But you could add the printer and outsource the design as well. But the last frontier really is how good is the quality of our input? And if we can glean that data from the patient's actual motion, I think it has the potential to give us a level of accuracy we really haven't had prior to this.
100%.
Yeah, because everything we've been using before was just some, it was as best as we could do representation of what we were seeing.
Yep.
And trying to communicate that back to the lab. But three-dimensional face scanning and all the other camera capture that we're going to be able to get, I think, in the next few years very consistently will then actually put the patient on the laboratory technician's desk for the first time, which has been a big missing piece of the puzzle.
Oh, for sure. I mean, digital offers a means of control and experiments we have never had. And what I mean by that is you could take the same articulator and give it to the same technician, identical models four times. All the splints are going to vary slightly just because they're going through it by hand. It's hard to replicate those motions. You're not really going through the entire range. And that was kind of the most interesting thing on the digital side is like, if you go a digital, if you go into D3 tools and you give the splint the same input or the program, the same input, you get the same output every single time. And what's nice with that is then we can start changing inputs. So I would initially start customizing intracondylar distance only. And you could see 110 versus 70 with everything else being identical, how much of a change it made. And between customizing our intracondylar distance and then doing a better hinge axis relation with the CT, it cut my splint insertion time down dramatically. And we're talking like a flat plane group function splint. So you really don't have a lot of room to miss without paying for it on the adjustment side. And, you know, I used to allot an hour and 20 for those adjustments to get it right. And I'm down to 15, 20 minutes most times.
That's awesome.
And so that's been a huge time savings. I know Jim McKee saw the same thing. That's kind of where he and I started talking was about splints and seeing if he could get him to do it. And he's seen a similar reduction in his insertion time. And so it took him a little while to come around, but I don't think he would go back at this point.
We're old timers. He's my
generation. A believer out of Jeff tonight too. So.
Yeah. But no, this is amazing stuff. And Seth, I hope you'll come back. Sure. I hope you're comfortable being a guest on the show again, because we sure did love having you and we appreciate your time. We know you're doing a lot of things these days, but what terrific insight. And I could tell just from the comments just how much our viewers that were on tonight got. And, you know, so many more will be watching this as it stays on Facebook, you know, ongoing, where they can go back and watch it. And we'll cut out your segment. It'll go to a podcast. So a lot of people are going to hear this. And so your impact on many, many dentists is truly appreciated. So we thank you for your time. And we hope to see you really soon. And with that, JB, would you want to close us out?
Oh, I would love to. Seth, thanks so much for being on. Hopefully we'll get to meet in person someday. Sure. In the meantime, I'm going to be watching the Masters this weekend. I'm looking for Seth's granddad. Maybe he's just going to drop the bomb on all of us that he's actually just attending this weekend. Maybe he's even playing because he likes to drop this little truth bomb.
My damn ball's caught in these azaleas here.
Pretty much how it went.
Exactly. Like, you know, no big deal. I was Tiger's caddy or, you know, something along those lines. Guys, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it. We hope your week finishes out strong. We'll look forward to seeing you again next week. Have a great night.
A great night, everyone. Thanks again, Seth.
Anytime.
And that wraps up another podcast for Dentists in the Know. On behalf of Dr. Jennifer Bell, Dr. Chad DePlantis, and myself, remember that we've got a great profession, so let's make it a great day, Dinks.